The next paper discussed by the group was an update of the HERA study that was presented at ASCO by Dr. Ian Smith. This presentation demonstrated a very impressive disease-free and now overall survival advantage for the addition of trastuzumab to a variety of adjuvant chemotherapy regimens, as commented on by Dr. Huddis.
The one thing that struck me about HERA, and it's just a comment, is that the hazard for recurrence actually blipped upward after the year of Herceptin ended in that trial. And I think that that leaves very wide open that door that prolonged treatment may actually be better than just a year. Many people were excited because of the FinHER data with 9 weeks of treatment lowering the risk of recurrence and death significantly, and that's probably real. I'm not disputing that. But the idea that they've got the two-year versus one-year treatment data sitting out there unreported, and the fact that the hazard for recurrence went up at the end of the first year of treatment when Herceptin stopped, it's interesting. That's all. I mean, it may not turn out to be anything, but I thought it was provocative. And that was the most interesting slide that I thought Ian Smith actually showed there. The rest of it was very much what was expected.
Chuck, what was your thought about that slide and the HERA data in general?
What struck me about it was it looked like the lines were moving together and suggesting that there is a gain from giving the Herceptin concurrently with chemotherapy that might allow you to not have to give it indefinitely, or if you do that, maybe the benefits of the long-term therapy are much smaller than they are when that's the only way you give it. I haven't had a chance to look at that, but I remember seeing that thing flash by. That's what struck me. I've heard other people, that was their impression as well.
Yeah, they did move together because the Herceptin arm popped up to match the chemo arm after the Herceptin ended. It's interesting.
I also agree with Chuck that as I looked at it, what I saw was that the curves by 2 years were paralleling each other.
Yeah.
And that is reminiscent to me of chemotherapy effect, which is that you see your biggest effect early on and that you have relatively little effect against late events. So there are two ways of interpreting it, I think. One of them is that we need to give more than 1 year, but the other way of interpreting it is that you get the benefit that you get against early recurrence, and it's not clear what you're going to get as time goes on.
Dabu, what was your take on the HERA data?
Well, I think that the migrating hazard ratio is not necessarily a comment on duration of therapy. One can see the exact same trend if the late relapsers have a different benefit than the early relapsers. And we already know from the HERA study that the early relapsers are enriched for ER negative. 60% were ER negative, whereas 48% were enrolled on the overall trial. So it may simply be that we might find that there's a difference in effect from the late relapsers. So I wouldn't necessarily make any inferences on that. We commonly see hazard ratios migrate over time, so we just need to see how this matures.
The other issue to keep in mind is that these were studies, the FinHER study and the HERA trial were studies with very different designs, in that the HERA trial was a study of single agent trastuzumab following chemotherapy, while the FinHER study was a study with concomitant chemotherapy. And it's way too early to be definitive about any of this, but it could very well be that with combination chemotherapy, you may get away with a short schedule. If you're doing sequential, you may require a longer schedule of unknown duration at this point.
Just to clarify, the FinHER trial was a relatively small study. If there were a difference, let's say a 20% difference between using 9 weeks versus 1 year, do you think we would have been able to see it with those data?
The point estimate was very similar to what our studies were, but as you're saying, the confidence interval was so wide around that it went from like 20 to 80, so you had no idea head-to-head. I mean, to me it meant it supported the idea that Herceptin is an awfully important drug, and no matter how you give it to a HER2-positive patient, they get substantial benefit. And certainly if you have somebody who you're worried about cardiotoxicity, it provides rationale to me for getting it in early, but then not being afraid of stopping if you get any signal that you might be running into problems.
The other thing that strikes me from the data from last year that was presented by the joint analysis as far as the optimal duration of trastuzumab is actually the fact that up to 20% of the patients in the joint analysis did not complete a full year of trastuzumab and still derived substantial benefit from the use of the drug. So truly asking the question, even perhaps could be less than 1 year, be what you need.
Yeah. But we really haven't seen that analysis. The analysis we really want to see is what happened to the patients that stopped after 3 months. And that we haven't seen. That's going to be confounded, of course, by the fact
we're waiting for more events, because the likelihood of being able to learn anything real looking at the original decision was made, let's wait for the event. So we look at a point where we can have, I guess, a little more confidence in what we might see.
But it is going to be very challenging to do that analysis because you're talking about a much smaller number of events and a completely separate issue, but still relevant to the black and white benefit versus no benefit assumptions that we make, is the whole issue of differential levels of gene amplification, which we also don't have any information
and
right now.
I guess another thing is that that 9-week regimen certainly has a hazard ratio very similar to all the rest of the regimens, and I think some of the Europeans will make the point where we're in the U.S. giving pretty much routinely concurrent chemotherapy with the Herceptin, and they would point out that the only outlier that they see is Edith Perez's subgroup analysis, which is the only one that really shows a substantially less benefit in that one subgroup. And so they said we're basing it all on an unplanned subgroup, which is the outlier from all the rest of the major analyses, even for the small trial. And that's an important point because that also fits into the same question here in terms of concurrent versus after the chemotherapy.
Chuck? Two comments on that. It's interesting, though, with the Europeans saying that, they're also talking about modifying the Aphrodite study to let docs give chemotherapy concurrently with the Herceptin. So that's starting to shift because, for practical reasons, they're moving over. The other thing is, in our 9831 B31 report, we had to peel out some of our figures. And so the New England Journal article doesn't have the hazards in there, but they're in the supplement, and they look very different in the first few years on our study giving it concurrently than what those HERA things. And what I've not yet had a chance to do is put them side by side, but they are quite different. And I think it'd be interesting to look at the two side by side.
Craig?
I think we're discounting, in our discussion at least, the fact that we have a lot of preclinical data on synergy between Herceptin and chemotherapy. Much more so, we're used to kind of doing the preclinical studies, animal studies, then we get in the clinic and we kind of forget it all. And that's kind of the way we're discussing it here, is if we can answer all of these things. But the preclinical data is pretty compelling, and I think we should be very, very careful about throwing out the possibility that it's not only a matter of synergy, but which drugs you use. There's a huge debate about whether the initial trials should use Taxol, which was advocated by the folks from Memorial based on BT-474 data, or carboplatin, where there were a lot of elegant data where we thought we knew at least, what the molecular biology was that resulted in increased sensitivity to carboplatin. So I think that not only whether we use them together or not, but also the specific drugs that are used could be a very important factor, and the HERA trial didn't control for any of that.
Craig, do you think that there's a role for trastuzumab as monotherapy without chemotherapy, the older, frail patient who you don't want to give chemotherapy to, for example?
Yeah, I probably would be willing to look at it. I certainly wouldn't give it much credence in the main line at this point. I think the data on synergy, both preclinically and clinically, is just too compelling to spend much time on that in the vast majority of patients.
Chuck, our 82-year-old patient with an ER-PR negative, highly amplified, whether that makes a difference or not, HER2 positive tumor, would you present the option of trastuzumab monotherapy?
I don't think that's unreasonable. Again, I would have to be really convinced that chemotherapy was not indicated in that patient. And in your 77-year-old patient that you gave in your example, I gave aggressive chemotherapy, so...
And I think one way to get away with this problem with an elderly person who you're concerned about the potential toxicity, in this case cardiac toxicity, might be to try to use a non-anthracycline regimen. So you could be using the TCH regimen, for which we have data, or if you're even concerned about the toxicity associated with docetaxel at higher doses, you may just create a regimen, and the one that I can think of at this point would simply be to abolish DAC and use weekly paclitaxel for 12 weeks, which is highly tolerable in most patients, with the trastuzumab, where you may be potentially getting the synergism from the chemotherapy combination and avoiding the anthracycline cardiotoxicity, understanding the lack of data to support that.
Cliff?
So just for fun, the last patient I saw yesterday was a patient that I've treated for about 4 years now. 4 years ago, she had a node-positive, ER-positive, HER2-negative breast cancer, for which I started her on AC and planned to give her Taxol. She was 71 then, and she stroked during the AC and has a partial aphasia. She's a beautiful woman with a lot of plastic surgery who's kept herself up, very physically fit, and she said enough, right? So she went on adjuvant Arimidex, and that was that. She came in with an abnormal mammogram about 6 weeks ago, and yesterday I saw her in clinic, status post bilateral mastectomy, contralateral new cancer, ERPR negative, FISH of 7.5, and a positive lymph node, and a big honking hole in her chest wall where her breast had been because she didn't heal up her wound because she's on chronic steroids for colitis.
What is the take-home message from this story?
The take-home message is, I said, it's a good thing there's Herceptin. Because that's what she's getting is a single adjuvant therapy.
Perfect candidate for Herceptin monotherapy,
yeah.
Cliff.
Perfect candidate. We have a consensus that in this situation it was
not
the
only is that reasonable, but so also is the weekly taxane with Herceptin for an older patient who isn't going to tolerate anthracycline so well, because we've had the same experience where we start with a weekly taxane because the patient's kind of sick, and you get to the anthracycline, and that's where they have their MI, they stroke, they whatever go on.
And we tried to give THC to an 83-year-old lady who had a 7-centimeter fungating lesion with palpable lymphadenopathy. She didn't tolerate, not too surprisingly, the chemotherapy part of it. We stopped the chemotherapy. Her tumor was shrinking. We continued with 3 more cycles of Herceptin, and at surgery, that's the first time it happened, she was a pathological complete response in the breast and in the lymph nodes. That's the first time I've ever seen a fungating lesion be a pathological complete response.
Well, Joyce, you were talking about Jenny Chang's preoperative data. She also did preoperative looking just at trastuzumab alone for 3 weeks in women with locally advanced breast cancer in the Indigen Clinic there, and saw a significant response rate and a lot of stories just the way Rowan said. Have you tried that strategy at all?
No, I have not given preoperative Herceptin by itself to anybody.
What about adjuvant Herceptin monotherapy?
I usually try to sneak in a little low-dose weekly Taxol on these very, very comorbid type patients. So I don't know that I've tried, but I'm thinking I saw a patient recently where she was extremely elderly, and I think I was looking at an AI and Herceptin alone for her.
Craig?
Of the first 5 responders to Herceptin, patients with breast cancer in the first phase 2 trial, one of them had a complete response. Patient continued for 5 years on Herceptin, and the last I heard, and maybe Cliff can update us as it's in his chop, but the
still
last I heard, which
disease.
Was a fellow that treated her originally, she was completely disease-free at 13 years.
Still true.
ERPR negative disease, do you recall?
I don't remember.
We
she
have
was metastatic
similar patients
recurrent disease.
Yeah.
Who
but
have,
not
adjuvant.
Yeah, been disease-free now for 8-10 years who started on the original studies.
Right. I do have to bring up Soon Paik's CMIC data, because I think that it will be great if somebody else can confirm what we have seen, because it is remarkable the difference that we see between the two patients. And again, a lot of it is the hazards. The co-amplified patients with chemotherapy do very poorly in the control group, and we're still waiting for a recurrence after 2 years with the addition of the Herceptin. I mean, it's just remarkable, the separation of those curves and the plateauing. I mean, it really is suggesting something's going on there. And the interesting thing on the CMIC non-amplified, we're seeing recurrences, the curves separate, but it looks like a typical chemotherapy curve, and that you're seeing continuing recurrences even with Herceptin. Like, there's something going on there. So we're very anxious to see what happens, and we're struggling with that in the replacement study, because if your CMIC positive patients are well above 90% with standard therapy alone, do you want to continue that third of patients in layering on more treatments?
How are you going to improve on such a good thing?
If that is true, then maybe the difference between what we're seeing in our concurrent therapy and the sequential isn't providing that benefit in that subset of patients.
Dabu, I'm curious where you think things are heading in terms of Topo 2, both in the HER2 positive and the HER2 negative patient, in terms of clinical application. I mean, the assay is out there. Is it something that should be considered or could be considered in clinical decision making at this point? And if not, where do you think that's heading?
Well, we've known for years that Topo 2 overexpression does confer sensitivity to anthracyclines. This has been shown in cell line models dating back to 10, 15 years ago. So now that we see Topo 2 seems to predict a better response to anthracycline, and maybe the lack of it or mutations means that anthracyclines are not as important, is carrying more weight now. What I would like to see would be that the results from the BCIRG study are replicated from data sets from both HERA and from the American studies, the NSABP and the intergroup studies, and that should be eminently doable, and from what I understand is underway, or at least plans are underway. My guess is that it will end up being significant. I don't think it's the only factor, but I do think that it will enter into clinical utility in some cases. I think there are going to be cases where we do want to withhold an anthracycline and maybe use just a taxane and trastuzumab. So it's not ready for prime time use, but it should soon.
Peter?
I think within a year we're all going to be using it. And I'll tell you, there are now 4 European studies that they discussed at ASCO doing a meta-analysis. We've seen results from 3 of the studies which are positive. So it's very hard to believe that the meta-analysis is not going to be positive. The assay is ready to go. It's a FISH assay. The one thing that has held up this whole field is the use of immunohistochemistry, because there's relatively poor correlations between amplification and deletion events, and actually level is assessed by immunohistochemistry. So I think that the studies that have used FISH have been consistently positive, and the BCRG is, I guess, one of those 4 studies, and we're about to see the results.
Perhaps the most discussed breast cancer paper at the recent ASCO meeting was a trial in metastatic HER2-positive disease in patients who had received prior anthracyclines and taxanes and progressing on trastuzumab, comparing capecitabine plus the dual tyrosine kinase inhibitor lapatinib to capecitabine alone. Dr. Charles Geyer presented this paper at ASCO and reviewed the findings for the think tank group.
This was a phase 3 trial of the approved dose of capecitabine as a control versus the phase 1 combination dose, which brought the capecitabine down to 2,000. Patient population for this study were women who had had progression of breast cancer and had received prior anthracycline, taxane, and trastuzumab. They were to have had progression on trastuzumab in the metastatic setting. They could not have had prior capecitabine. This study was discussed at length with the FDA when it was being developed, and there was a strong consensus that because it was an unblinded study, that time to progression that would be used for the definitive analysis would be endpoints as defined by an independent review committee who would look at all the films, all the photographic assessments, and then assign response status, progression status based on their review, and that would drive the analysis. And basically then when the IDMC looked at it, they recommended early closure of the trial because the boundary had been crossed for superiority. And basically the median time to progression was improved from 4.5 to 8.5 months, and it crossed the boundary. Response rate was also increased from 14% to 22%, though this did not meet statistical significance. A interest, of course, with lapatinib is the potential impact it might have in reducing CNS events, and so this was something that was tracked, and there were clearly numerically fewer, 4 versus 11, though again, it was too few total events to make any definitive statement. Toxicity was a concern going in since there was overlapping toxicity, and we did have overall increases in diarrhea, hand, foot, skin rashes, but really virtually no grade 4 toxicity, and the grade 3 toxicities really weren't appreciably different. And then for the other toxicities, again, just no grade 4 at all and minimal grade 3. So the concern about additive toxicity of the lapatinib to the capecitabine really wasn't borne out. Final thing on this study, because of the cardiac toxicity issue with HER2 blockade, there was very careful cardiac monitoring. Patients got scans basically every 6 weeks for the first 6 months and then every 12 weeks. Very conservative criteria were used for a cardiac event. Patients who had symptoms, symptomatic heart failure obviously would have been considered as having an event, but also patients who had asymptomatic declines with a relative decrease more than 20% from baseline to below normal were considered as an event. And on the study, there were 4 of those with the lapatinib capecitabine, 1 with the capecitabine alone. All were asymptomatic.
Thanks, Chuck. I'd like to begin with Dubu in terms of what your take is in terms of lapatinib and sort of where that's going to be heading, both clinically as well as in trials.
Well, I think this is a very interesting story. When lapatinib was first studied in refractory patients, the response rates were quite low, even if you look at HER2 patients. But there was some concern as to whether we were testing this drug appropriately. Might it be cytostatic? And we've seen at ASCO other presentations, randomized discontinuation of potentially active agents, but that just don't have response rates. They prolong time to disease progression. So I think it was very interesting that this study showed almost a doubling of the time to disease progression without a concomitant increase in the response rate that was significantly different. So I think this is going to be a very important drug in this population of patients, but I think one can extend this even further and ask the question as to whether it will delay time to disease progression in HER2 patients with upfront therapy and then, of course, with adjuvant therapy, and all of these questions are planned.
Cliff?
I just want to ask Chuck if you want to expand for the group, because not everybody probably saw the subtlety of the presentation that you made at ASCO. The time of assessments changed from every 6 weeks to 12 weeks, right at the 24-week mark, and there was a fair number of patients who were censored out by the central committee, and the investigator assessed time to progression, if I remember correctly, was 18 versus 25 weeks, becoming 19 versus 36 when reviewed centrally. So I think we have to be a little careful about the magnitude of this stable disease, because patients who might have been on the way to progression are never counted as progressing because they were taken off before they literally hit the progression point, and they would have dragged down that curve sooner.
By the independent review group.
Right.
Because of the vagaries of RESIST, which is a...
Doesn't diminish the impact of the drug from my point of view, and actually it's robustly significant if you just take the investigator-assessed time to progression, but it's not going to impress your patients as much to say 7 weeks or 8 weeks as it does to say doubling or 19 weeks or 18.
Yeah. Yeah, the encouraging thing that was done with that, a number of sensitivity analyses were done. We also took the worst-case scenario, whoever said there was progression first, and the hazard held continually right at 50% no matter how we did it. So the effect is substantial. But the actual number, because of that censoring phenomena, plus it did happen to be the jump in time when the assessments went from every 6 to every 12.
It's worth reminding everybody, because you were part of this. I know the Herceptin pivotal trial actually could have had the same problem, but they used central review of progression in real time, and you would send your scans in, and they would adjudicate progression, and you would keep the patient on or take them off in response to the real-time central review committee. So that's a way of avoiding that kind of interesting effect.
I think it's important to recognize that time to progression is a very fuzzy endpoint, and this is true in all trials, and especially when the curves look the way they do, where there's sort of a plateau right at that 50% number of when half the patients have progressed. So we have to keep that in mind for all studies.
Craig?
Well, I just made the comment, that's enough to kill an NDA. I mean, this is what Rick Pazdur is talking about all the time. It's unfortunate, because time to progression, I think, is such an important endpoint at this point for a lot of our drugs going forward. I agree with the points that Debu made, but the problem here is in the execution. And the execution for that endpoint has to be letter perfect.
Antonio?
One question which was posed, I believe, by Nick Robert after the presentation is whether this study could potentially indirectly be addressing a question that we have been unable to answer so far, which is whether continuation of anti-HER2 therapy is truly important on the patient that is progressing on first-line HER2 therapy. So the study that was never able to be done was for patients who were receiving paclitaxel and trastuzumab and at progression are randomized to simply switching chemotherapy, in that case to vinorelbine plus trastuzumab versus vinorelbine alone. And this study essentially is a study where it's asking the question on the patient that is progressing on trastuzumab, thus switching to another chemotherapy but continuing an anti-HER2 therapy, in this case lapatinib, is it better than not continue the targeted therapy? And the answer in this case is yes. So how much is an effect of lapatinib in itself as being a drug that is active in patients who have progression on trastuzumab, and how much it's simply a continuation of anti-HER2 therapy? Maybe Chuck or others could comment.
And also, Chuck, the issue of the combination of lapatinib and trastuzumab, and looking at the numbers in terms of how recently the patients were on trastuzumab, you would expect that some of these people actually had trastuzumab on board. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, that's why we broke out the four to eight, and eight or more. Clearly, the people who crossed over within 4 weeks still had substantial amounts of Herceptin. That second group had some, but it was fading fast, and the last one presumably did not have any. And we are going to do the exploratory analysis when the data gets pulled up to when the IDMC met and basically closed the trial on March 20th. That cut points from November 15th, so we have more events, and we're going to do that before we take a look at that. That's an obvious question, but we decided not to look yet.
I'm curious, Joyce, how do you approach patients, I don't know if you have many or any right now, who are progressing after receiving adjuvant trastuzumab in terms of deciding whether to reinstitute trastuzumab, if lapatinib were available or when it becomes available, how would you factor that in?
I haven't actually had to cross that bridge. I think it'd be the kind of thing where it would depend on the disease-free interval, and if it was very brief, I'd be looking for lapatinib. But that's a particularly important area, I think, to find out whether we really need Herceptin to maximize the effectiveness of lapatinib or not. If somebody who's had a decent disease-free interval, they obviously are somewhat resistant to the Herceptin, but they still may retain some sensitivity. So I think the randomized trial that they're doing right now of lapatinib alone versus lapatinib plus Herceptin is a very important trial. I think it's accruing fairly well, and so we should have that answer.
Hope?
That trial is interesting because it required in its initial manifestation up until this moment that you receive two prior chemotherapy regimens for metastatic disease and that you also receive trastuzumab for metastatic disease. So it's not testing the question of what do you do if somebody's relapsed within a year of adjuvant therapy by any means, which is most unfortunate, since if you've relapsed on adjuvant trastuzumab, you don't qualify for the trial, but you will qualify for compassionate use in the capecitabine lapatinib compassionate study, which is available now. And also, they have another trial testing the combination with paclitaxel, but you can't have relapsed on trastuzumab. You have to be off of it. But you then are randomized as first-line therapy to paclitaxel with trastuzumab versus the addition of lapatinib. So that would be one way to try and look at those issues. I think that the big question that we have is there are all these trials going on now that we're not going to have the results for a little bit, and yet right now we have to finalize the neoadjuvant and adjuvant trial designs, which is incredibly controversial, and there are tremendous variations in opinion. We've all been having this email conversation within our cooperative group, and there is definitely no consensus. I mean, how do we test this now in the adjuvant setting? How do we bring lapatinib into the adjuvant setting in the best way without creating a $500 million trial?
Cliff, can you comment on some of the options that are being discussed in terms of the next generation of adjuvant trials for HER2-positive patients?
So the Aphrodite trial is currently written as overlapping with chemotherapy if you want a year of Herceptin, a year of lapatinib, a year of both, or a sequence of one then the other. The Neo-Aphrodite trial tries to get at some of the biology of this by giving, I think it's 12 or 16 weeks of the single agents alone or the combination alone before you go to surgery and then following with a remainder of a year of treatment. In the cooperative groups, the North Central proposal, which is currently being worked on, is built on the same themes of single agent lapatinib versus single agent trastuzumab versus the combination. And we have a preoperative proposal which matches that, which gives preoperative trastuzumab, preoperative lapatinib, or preoperative combination along with weekly paclitaxel for a fixed period of time. It gives us a chance to look at the pathway markers and markers of resistance. The big controversy, which is the obvious one, is whether people are brave enough, as the Aphrodite folks appear to be, to commit to a year of lapatinib and not give any Herceptin to a HER2-positive patient with early-stage disease. And that's either brilliant or a leap of faith. And I don't really know where things stand for everybody right now, but that's the bone of contention right now.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our speakers, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for this special Breast Cancer Update Think Tank Edition.